Let's make this beginning brief, or at least brief by my verbose, overly loquacious standards. When you're lost in the infinite inning, and you can't find a way to make it end, when you are forced to face the possibility that it might be your fault because you lack the skill to make it stop, there is a temptation simply to lay down and surrender. Marv Thornberry, Marvelous Marv, played first base for the Mets in their inaugural season of 1962. He wasn't one of the guys they selected in the expansion draft, except maybe indirectly. The Mets actually acquired him in a trade with the Orioles. They had to send cash and a player to be named later. And the player to be named later was their very first pick in the expansion draft, a catcher named Hobart Landreth, popularly known as Hobie. Thornberry comes down to us as kind of a joke, but getting him wasn't a bad idea exactly. Like all those Mets, he was a journeyman, overage and bald at 28, but there was some pop in his left-handed bat. In 925 minor league games, he had hit over 200 home runs, clearing 30 in a season 5 times. You have to put an asterisk on some of those numbers because 3 of those seasons came at Denver, but still, there were reasons to think that they might luck into an undiscovered slugger who had just never had the chance to play regularly. They weren't wholly off base about that, but the problem was that Thornberry was clawed. It wasn't so much that he made mistakes, everybody makes mistakes, but that a lot of his mistakes came from a lack of situational awareness. His manager, Casey Stengel, once said that when you're losing, everyone commences to play in stupid. That was Thornberry's problem. He might not have been stupid, but he played stupid. He hit 170 with runners in scoring position, something everybody noticed even if they didn't have the exact numbers around, and Stengel complained that he would swing even when it was clear the other team was pitching around him. He just didn't have the capacity to understand that. Probably the most famous Thornberry story is the time that he hit a triple, but the umpires called him out because he hadn't touched second base. Stengel rushed out to argue, but before he could even get started, the umpire said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, Casey, before you argue, he didn't touch first base either." Stengel just kind of stood there and said, "I know he touched third because he's standing on it." You can find that one. As Casey would have said, you can look it up. It was June 17, 1962. It was the first game of a doubleheader against the Cubs. In that same game, in fact, the inning before his non-triple-triple, he was called for defensive interference on a rundown, the error leading to 4 unearned runs crossing the plate, and that was the difference in the game. In the nightcap, he booted a grounder on the very first play. No wonder, then, that when the club celebrated Thornberry's birthday that September, Stengel said, "We didn't get you a cake because you would have dropped it." I'm sorry. Casey could be cruel sometimes, but I love him. The Mets played in the Polo Grounds, the ballpark vacated by the Giants after the 1957 season. It had been renovated a little bit for them, but it had last been truly rebuilt in 1911. Possibly bits of it dated from the 1890s, I'm not sure. The building was kind of done. It hadn't been well maintained. Thornberry lockered next to Richie Ashburn, the future Hall of Fame outfielder, then 35 years old, whose feelings about playing for the Mets, I mean, you know how in "The Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes," Elvis Costello sings, "I used to be disgusted, but now I try to be amused"? Ashburn was in that place. On one hand, he hit .306 with a .424 on base percentage. He was great. On the other hand, he retired as soon as the season ended because he had to get away from the Mets. One day, the Mets played a wet, rain-soaked game in which Thornberry had done typically Thornberry-ish things. The clubhouse leaked. Specifically, it leaked over Thornberry's locker. Possibly it didn't leak anywhere else, just on Thornberry. In any case, he just sat there and took it. He let the water just drip down on him. And he had gone bald, so you know he was feeling those cold stings directly on his scalp. When Ashburn wondered what it was he was doing, Thornberry just said, "I deserve it." "Yes," Ashburn said, "yes, you do." I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. First-person shooter you'd been playing had been quite relaxing until, late last night, one of the NPCs you had just executed sat up on his bloody elbows and called to you by name. Not your character's name, but your name.
He rises and gestures for you to follow him. Reluctantly, heart beating fast, you pursue him to a darkened spot that had never before appeared on the game map. You're rewarded with a vision of the damned, all of whom wear your face. Throwing down your controller, you flee the house, seeking the relative safety and holy absolution of Episode 10. Next time, you'll stick with Candy Crush. Whew, not sure where that came from. Kind of make these up about 10 seconds before I turn on the microphone, and I guess that's where my head was at this morning. Last night, I had this nightmare that I went to Disney World, which my kids are pressing for, and there was a new ride, Walt Disney Knows What You're Thinking, in which your thoughts were broadcast onto large screens as you tooled around the ride building. The theme park of humiliation, that's a recurring motif for me. And I guess the first-person shooter from hell is just adjacent to that on the psychic map. Now we know. If you've survived that, I'm glad you're back with us. This week, we're joined by Sports on Earth's Cliff Corcoran, the man of 1,000 baseball caps, back in his usual spot. And he and I will talk about the race between the Indians and Twins in the AL Central, and whether the Royals should count themselves as part of that race, or if they should trade. Authenticity in teams versus authenticity in rock bands. Ballplayers with fish-associated names. And Cliff gets really upset about caps and uniforms again. You don't want to miss that. Do I sound a little sleepy there? I hope not, because I'm actually quite exercised. And before we get to Cliff, I want to return to the subject of the opening segment, the 1962 Mets, or really this is about the 1961 Mets, which sounds like a mistake until you realize that the Mets came into existence formally with the expansion draft of October 1961, which happened about 3 seconds after the last ball of that year's World Series dropped. In previous episodes, I've told you that we don't have to talk explicitly about anything but baseball, and yet I urge you to think about things through baseball, because the same brain that you use to apply to trades, to whether a player has a sufficient on-base percentage or not, or anything else that goes with this great game of ours, that power of ratiocination can be applied to the world around you, and you are less likely to get fooled. People are reluctant to do that because of ideology, which gives you a fixed blueprint instead of an adaptive, responsive system for dealing with the unexpected, with the changing world around us. You know how Joe Girardi will sometimes put the wrong pitcher in the wrong spot in a game, but he'll say, well, I had to go to him there. That was the eighth inning. He's the eighth inning guy. That's an ideology. Girardi knows full well that he constructed that ideology and that he can break with it at any time, but he doesn't want to, because if you give it up, if you give up that guide, that map, then life gets uncertain and scary. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with having fixed principles in this life. Certainly we should have some things that we're inflexible about. But there's a reason for the old military saying that no plan of battle survives contact with the enemy. What you do on paper almost never matches the circumstances that you are confronted with in life. And that is why I've often said, and I've written this a million times, if you've read me say it before, then I apologize for repeating myself, but anytime ideology is emphasized at the expense of pragmatism, you've avoided the labor of thinking, and you are always required to think, because if you don't, you might lead off Alcides Escobar. Or worse things, although it's hard to imagine there are worse things. As I've been saying, we don't have to talk explicitly about anything but baseball, so I'll leave what those worst things might be to you. Consonant with that, there's a reason the 1961 expansion draft is topical. It's because when you're presented with a system that's designed not to work, we shouldn't be surprised when it doesn't work. And in fact, someone who says it will is lying to you, and someone who insists that it won't harm them is in denial. The American League had expanded for the 1961 season, adding the Los Angeles, California, Anaheim, Angels, whatever you want to call them. It's okay with me. It's probably okay with them, too. And the Washington Senators, the second version of that team, after the first one had gone off to Minnesota, in a futile effort to run away from their own racism. It didn't work. They were still pretty racist. Now it was the National League's turn. In Houston, they added the Colt 45s, who I'm going to call the Astros from now on because I know I'm going to do it. I'm going to mess up, so I might as well just get it out of the way. They're the Astros. In New York, they added the Mets to replace the departed Dodgers and Giants. If you need to populate some expansion teams, you hold an expansion draft. Both leagues did that, but there were significant differences in the way that they went about it. In both cases, the existing teams had to submit a list of 15 players from their organization, 7 of whom had been on the 40-man roster as of August 31st. Now that led to some predictable shenanigans in terms of good young players being sent down right before the deadline so they weren't eligible. Fine, swell, can't really avoid that. The key difference between the two leagues' drafts was this.
As you know, every winter, eligible young players have to be added to their team's 40-man roster, or they are open to being picked off by other organizations in the Rule 5 draft. The American League draft happened after the 40-man rosters were finalized for the winter. The National League draft happened before it. What that meant in practice was that the American League teams had to add some promising kids to the draft pool, and it worked out that way. The Angels picked up Jim Fregosi, a slugging shortstop from the Red Sox, and the Senators selected Dean Chance, a guy with a Cy Young kind of arm, and in fact he did later win a Cy Young award. That they foolishly traded him to the Angels immediately after selecting him, that's on them, but the fact is that he was there to be picked. By moving the date of their draft up, the National League ensured that no one that good would be available to the Mets and Astros. When Paul Richards, Houston's general manager, saw the list of available players, he told his colleagues, "Gentlemen, we've just been fucked." He tried to get the Mets to boycott the draft, but they wouldn't go along. And so the draft happened. Each team reacted to the absence of good players by adopting a different philosophy. Richards tried to draft the best players available. The Mets tried to draft the best players that New Yorkers had heard of before. Former Brooklyn Dodgers like Don Zimmer, Roger Craig, and Gil Hodges might not have much left to give on the field, but the Mets understood that, given the players available, that they and the Astros were going to be very bad regardless of who they picked, so they might as well at least be comfortable, like an old shoe. M. Donald Grant, who was chairman of the new team, said, "We're going to have to exist on sentiment for a year or two." He meant that general manager George Weiss would be building the team up through the farm system, while these veterans and manager Casey Stengel held the team up on their names and reputations, if nothing else. What Grant, who really wasn't meant to be in baseball, didn't realize was that 2 years was an incredible underestimation of how long the Mets would have to rely on sentimentality. In fact, both teams were crippled by that draft. The Mets lost 120 games that first year, and 100 or more in 5 of their first 6 seasons. Their first winning season came simultaneously with their first World Championship in 1969. Meanwhile, the Astros were kind of cosmetically better, but they still lost 90 or more games for 7 straight years, including that first season, and they didn't have a winning campaign until 1972. This expansion draft was a bitter, bitter thing for everyone involved. And for the fans, too. Writing in the New Yorker, Roger Angel called the players made available to the Astros and Mets a miserable collection of coals and castoffs. And Jimmy Breslin, the New York columnist, compared what the National League had done to robbery in the daytime. See, they hadn't charged these expansion teams very much money to enter the league. They were going to make it up in fees. Fees that they charged to draft these players who weren't worth anything at all. Or at least very little. Bing Devine, who was general manager of the Cardinals then, was one of the architects of this draft. And he said, in an interview that I hope was kind of like one of those old 60 Minutes interviews where they buttoned a tobacco company executive and made him swear that his product didn't cause cancer, said, we didn't promise them anything. Who said they could have a contender right out of the gate? Who even said they'd be good? Stengel was angry for the rest of his career, which lasted until 1965. He constantly complained that his owner, Mrs. Joan Payson, had been robbed, had been taken advantage of. He would say things like, "I want to thank all those generous owners for giving us those great players they didn't want. Those lovely, generous owners." On another occasion, he looked over at the Dodgers, who had Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale and Maury Wills, and he said, "They're mahogany. We're driftwood." And he was hardly the only one who felt that way. Branch Rickey said the Mets had drafted players who are about to climb down the other side of the hill. Richie Ashburn, perhaps more gently, compared them to reading an old book. Don Zimmer is a great example of the kind of player the Mets wound up with. He had been a top prospect for the Dodgers in the early 1950s, a shortstop who hit 300 with power. He never had the slightest intention of taking a walk, but otherwise he looked good. He made it up to the majors in 1953, and he had some problems getting into the lineup because he had Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson in front of him. But there was possibility there. The problem, and we can never know how much of a problem it was that he was twice hit by pitches with devastating repercussions. In 1953, playing for AAA St. Paul, he was hit in the head and his skull was fractured, putting him in a coma for 10 days. He went through the rest of his life famously with bits of metal stuck in his head to plug up the spots where the doctors had to drill out bits of bone to relieve the pressure. Then, in 1956, a pitch from Hal Jeffcoat broke his cheekbone. Now, Zimmer played forever, through 1965, and the majors, the minors, even Japan, but he was never very good. It's hard to know if that was because he was forever altered by those incidents, or that lack of plate judgment was going to undermine him anyway. Regardless, when the Mets drafted him, he was 31, he was a career .238 hitter with a .291 on-base percentage, and that wasn't any better then than it is now. Zimmer went 1-for-4 in each of his first three games with the Mets in 1962. And it was perhaps at that point that someone asked Stengel if Zimmer was the heart of the team. Casey replied, "Why, he's beyond that. He's much more. He's the perdocious quotient of the qualificatalis. He's the lower intestine." And then he traded Zimmer to the Reds. He had been in a 1-for-40 slump that had included an 0-for-32. Zimmer was neither the first or the only original Met to go. Overall, 11 of the 22 players the Mets took in the expansion draft were gone by May. And so, with the help of the National League, the Mets and Astros proved again that eternal principle that nothing comes from nothing. Earlier, I quoted Bing Devine, who said, "Well, who promised them anything? Who said they were going to be good?" And look, that's the traditional view of an expansion team, right? None of them have been good. Some of them, like the Los Angeles Angels and the Arizona Diamondbacks, got off the mat pretty quickly. Others, like the Seattle Mariners, struggled for year after year, and at times it must have seemed like they would never get it right. Hell, when it comes to the Mariners, it still does seem that way sometimes. So this is an old idea, or at least as old as expansion, but it's not a very good one. Why would you start anything new, be it a business or a baby, knowing that you were going to handicap it before it even got out the door, instead making this blithe assumption that it would all work out in the long term just because if you build it, they will come, just because if you plunk a ballpark down in Miami or Tampa, and I don't mean to single out those two teams, but just because you do, people would come to it, they would gravitate to it, they would like it just because it was there. Instead of doing it right, instead of creating a viable market right off the bat, you make them have to succeed through this totally passive approach of just appealing to people on a sentimental basis, as the Mets did, rather than on a qualitative basis, which is much easier. Or better yet, why not both? But that was the plan, and this is the important part for us now. Not that it was the expansion draft, that's just the circumstances of the time, but that the National League had a plan. They looked at the American League, and they thought that draft was too generous to the incoming teams, and so they made sure the Mets and Astros would get nothing. They didn't care whether the New York Mets or the Houston market, which had never had Major League Baseball before, did well. What they cared about was that they retained their own prospects, and that they got the money out of the incoming ownership. That's it. That's all. They didn't have a wider concern for the game than that. And you can argue that based on the way that Major League Baseball is set up as a confederation, that they shouldn't have. But there was a reason for those expansions, as well as the franchise relocations of the previous decade, and it's that baseball was misaligned, and it was not serving the American public in the way that the American public was geographically distributed in the country at that time. So they needed it. The Giants needed it, the Cardinals needed it, the Phillies needed that realignment for the overall health of the game, and therefore, purely selfishly, for the value of their own franchises. But if you're the kind of person who can't see beyond the end of their own nose, who doesn't think of anything beyond their own needs, you can't see that. And so, the draft was bad because it was intended to be bad. A year later, Casey was still muttering about the expansion draft, now angry at his ownership, saying, "We took too many names, excellent names, high-salaried names, wonderful fellows, but at the end of their string." But he had also moved on to the seeming reluctance of other teams to trade with the Mets. "Everybody seems to be making deals but us. Don't other National League owners appreciate the fact that we have a terrific franchise? New York fans stood up and cheered for us last season, but how long will that enthusiasm last if we only win 40 games again, like in 1962? It's a shame to spoil that enthusiasm, but they ain't giving us a chance to improve. We have wealthy ownership. Mrs. Payson gives millions to art, and she'd spend just as much to get a good club. She'd even spend twice as much as a player is worth. But every time we try to make a deal, they say, 'Nobody helped us when we started out.' Why did they let us in the league if they don't want us to be competitive?" It's a great question. Why did they let us in the league if they don't want us to be competitive? It's not unlike asking, "If no one wants me to die, why won't they let me see a doctor?" I'll be back with Cliff Corcoran in just a moment. Thank you. Now's the time when we welcome back to the program the man still looking for that elusive 1914 Brooklyn Tip Tops cap. It's Cliff Corcoran time. How are you, Cliff?
I'm good. I love that intro, and I'll tell you why. As I just ordered a pair of caps, and I'm not happy with either one of them. I'm sending them both back.
Oh,
I'm
no.
So particular about things. My daughter's changing schools, and her old school, the name of the school started with an A, and its school colors were red and white and black. And so I got a contemporary Angels cap to wear to all the school events because it's just perfect. But now she's switching schools and she's going to a school that the name starts with an S and the colors are blue and yellow. Well, the late 80s, early 90s Mariners cap is perfect for that. You know, the Harold Reynolds style, the one that Ken Griffey started wearing when he first came up. And they have it at Mickey's Place, which is my kind of, or at least used to be my go-to for these historically accurate, although I think I've burned through most of the ones that meet my standards, hats. Ordered that hat, and in the process, I noticed that they had an original Padres cap that was in my size. Thrilled, I ordered both caps, but the Padres cap was all wrong. They've redesigned the logo, and the yellow is the wrong color, and they put a serif on the S, and it's not right, and it's a raised logo like they wear today, not a flat one, which is one of the attractions of the Mickey's Place caps, is that they have flat logos like they used to have pre-strike. And then on top of that, the Mariners cap, which the logo is perfect, has a stitching flaw and the volume of it's too big. So I'm a nitpicker and I can't deal with it. I'm sending them both back. Hopefully I can get a Mariners one switched out for one that's good. But the Padres, my hopes for a quality Padres cap have been dashed again and I'm so frustrated.
So this is not the accurate cap that, say, Nate Colbert would have worn.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's what I thought I had ordered. The Brooklyn Tip Tops, well, that's a whole other conversation. But you happen to just poke a finger in the wound to start me off there, Steve-O.
It's a talent of mine. Although I was thinking that as Federal League caps go, the Chicago Whales, say, had a whale, at least on their jerseys. I don't know if it was on their cap. But I don't think the Baltimore Terrapins had a turtle on their cap. And darn it, the Tip Tops were named for a loaf of bread. They were from a bread-making factory. Or sponsored or owned by a bread-making factory, you'd think they would have had a loaf of bread or a muffin or something, croutons on their cap, but I don't think they had that either.
Well, 1914, you know, cap logos were not as widespread as they are today. You know, a lot of teams, the Red Sox are a great example, just had a white hat. You know, that's it. Maybe in 1914 they put a sock on there or something, but actually no, because you look at those pictures of Babe Ruth when he first came up. Recently they had the anniversary of Fenway Park and they did all the throwbacks. The Red Sox jersey back then was pretty much white from head to toe with red socks and red lettering across the front, but that's it. You know, no details or accoutrements at all. You're talking 1914, the cap designs weren't necessarily all that interesting. This actually gets to something else I was thinking about. I'm obviously, having already ranted this much about the serif on a 1972 Padres cap or whatever it is, 1969 Padres cap. I'm obviously a very much interested in the details of uniforms. And I was watching a game the other day and the little additions, Paul Lucas of UniWatch calls it logo creep, just drive me absolutely crazy. There's so much visual information that I don't need when watching a game. I think back to, and of course, it's part of it is the, you know, good old days when I was a kid, everything was better. We grew up at a time when the game was not necessarily all that attractive. The stadiums were ugly. The uniforms, although we look back at them with fondness now, when that was the only option out there, were rather ugly, to be truthful. Whether it was that so many teams with the powder blue roads or the contrast color front panels or whatever it was, just some gaudy colors. But they didn't have the constant logo creep. And I was thinking back to the degree to which, you know, for example, I mentioned that Red Sox uniform. If you go back far enough, some uniforms had nothing on them at all. It was really just the color of your socks indicated what team you were on. Maybe there you'd get an old English letter on the chest shield and that was it, right? So I was thinking about the way that uniforms have developed all of this just stuff that's all over them. And so first it's some sort of chest insignia. And then after that, maybe you get a logo on the cap. And then it wasn't until the late 20s that teams started wearing numbers on the back. And it wasn't until, what, sometime in the 50s or even the early 60s when teams started wearing names. Maker's marks didn't appear on jerseys, I think, until the 80s. Then things have really started steamrolling around the time, I forget if it was in 93 or 95 or 94, somewhere around there is when you got the MLB logo on the back of the cap and the back of the jersey, which was the first, like, change in my consciousness that I really was just like, oh, that's just so ridiculous and unnecessary and we don't need it. Then, of course, this last year, actually starting with the playoffs last year, we saw now the new era logo on the side of the cap. Teams that have an all-star game will wear the all-star logo on the other side. So now you've got a hat that has four logos on it. At what point is it going to look like that old cap that Joe Torre wore in the wake of 9/11 with just random patches all over the place? Now we've got the MLB logo on the back of the pants. And supposedly, in a couple of years, Under Armour is going to take over from Majestic as the primary uniform maker in MLB. And there's going to be an Under Armour logo on the chest of every jersey, I think on the front right. Now think about the one that sticks in my head is the Tigers home jersey. The Tigers home jersey, somebody mentioned a number of years ago that it somehow looks whiter than every other team's home jersey. And I think part of that is because there's so much white space on that jersey. There's just the piping around the collar and the old English D, and that's really it. The entire right side of that jersey is blank. But now, or in a couple years, you're going to get a nice little Under Armour logo over there in addition to everything else. And it's just clutter, 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 clutter. It drives me bananas. And I so forgive the rant, but again, you put some lemon juice in the cut, you put some salt in there, and you just keep digging around.
I did remind myself of one of my favorite baseball quotes, and I'm not sure what it proves exactly because the Yankees are not an expansion team and the Padres are, and a later expansion team than some. And I don't remember if it was Greg Nettles or Goose Gossage who said this, but one year they pointed out that one way to symbolize the or sum up the difference between the playing for the Yankees and playing for the Padres was that playing for the Yankees meant that on Old Timers Day, Joe DiMaggio and Mickey Mantle came into the clubhouse. And for the Padres, Old Timers Day was Nate Colbert trying to sell you a used car.
Old Timers Days these days is mostly the guys from the 90s, and maybe you can get a couple of guys from the 70s to show up. But I did notice that Dr. Bobby Brown was there, and so there are some of the legitimate old timers are still showing up to that game. But I think that the Royals had one too, didn't they? Or they had a celebrity softball game. I don't know if they had an old timers game connected to it, but this is the time of year for that kind of thing. But I don't know how many of, I think the Dodgers do on occasion. You know, I mean, if you think of Padres old-timers, the first guy you think of is Tony Gwynn, and he's not available. So, right. I mean, that's difficult. When your franchise has one, you know, you have a George Brett, Tony Gwynn type character, but there is no old-timers day without that guy on some level. When you lose that guy, it's almost as if, well, maybe we shouldn't have old-timers day for a while.
You know, just to follow up on the uniform thing, we're still a good distance from going the full NASCAR. But I feel like we might get there someday. And the issue is not that I object to Major League Baseball squeezing in an extra 50 cents to whatever they can do to make money, fine. It's just that it's aesthetically ugly, it's distracting, and it just takes away from the overall ambiance of the game.
It's that distraction that does it for me. It's a lot of visual information that baseball is a hard game to watch, really. You know, if you're watching it casually and you're just interested in, is there a guy on first or is there not a guy on first? On that level, it's easy because you only have to look over every couple minutes. You can do something else. And, you know, when the crowd makes a noise, you look up. But if you're watching it on the level that we watch it, it's actually a very difficult game to watch because really if the pitches happen in a fraction of a second, there's movement and there's location and there's, you know, the whole game of inches aspect. And to watch that white ball and exactly where it goes, it's heading into a field of just so much visual information with the ads behind home plate and all the junk on the uniform. And the catcher's got his name and some logos and patches and things on his chest protector, which sometimes makes him look like Captain America or whatever. There's just there's so much visual information going. Never mind the fans in the background who are doing whatever they're doing, which is, of course, that's fine. They're supposed to be there. But all this extra stuff. I understand it's revenue, and I understand that we're going in one direction and we're never going back. So I'm tilting at windmills or whatever. But
to close out this unplanned segment on uniform changes, Cliff Corcoran's appearance this week brought to you by Mickey's of Cooperstown. Not really. We should look into it, possibly.
They might be sick of me. I don't know. I've sent more than one box back in the past, so they may not want to hear from me anymore.
I find myself thinking about all the times that someone has passed away. And it's not a Hall of Famer, and maybe you don't know who it is or you hadn't heard, and then you're watching a game and there's a ZQ on somebody's arm and you're not sure who ZQ was or if you should be very mournful about ZQ, or maybe it's something else altogether and they're not mourning ZQ. I don't know. Anyway, there's visual photographic evidence of some of the things that we're talking about, some of these contrasts, and One, you mentioned Babe Ruth, and there are many pictures of Babe Ruth before the Yankees put the interlocking NY on the chest, and he's just wearing a striped shirt, and it looks kind of like a pajama top or an undershirt or something. It's disconcertingly plain.
Ruth never wore the NY during his. They added the NY after he left the team. They didn't add it until 36.
So there you go. So he
and he also had a three. Their jerseys back then were 3/4 length. So yeah, he's wearing a long sleeve pinstripe shirt.
Right. It looks like he's ready for bed to me. I don't know. The converse of it is, and I'm reluctant to bring him up because I talked about him extensively during the introduction. But towards the end of Casey Stengel's life, he came to Yankee Stadium. Maybe it was Shea Stadium at that point for an old timers game. And they decided that they would honor him by adorning his basic Yankees uniform with the full logo of every team that he had played for or managed. And he played for every National League team except the Reds and the Cubs. He managed the Mets and the Dodgers and the Braves, obviously. He played for them too, or he didn't play for the Mets, but the others. So if you look at his uniform, it's just a horrible clutter of, I mean, they had to squeeze the Giants logo in vertically down the buttons, and both sides of his chest are covered in names. It's horrific, and you almost feel bad for him that he's had to be made a spectacle of this way.
I think on some level they were probably intending a comic effect there. I know Gaylord Perry for years has worn a jersey because Gaylord Perry played for a ton of teams. Is he wearing a logo on his Hall of Fame plaque? I can't remember. Maybe the Giants, but he had some of his best seasons with the Indians, and he won a Cy Young with the Padres, and he played for the Rangers and the Yankees and the Mariners and the Royals. He has a jersey that he would wear to Old Timers Day games. I don't know if he's still going to those games that has... I think it's actually a 1980s San Francisco Giants base with the stripes around the sleeves, but with the logos of all of those teams up and down both sides of the chest. Whether or not he was inspired by the Casey Stengel incident, that I don't know. But I know Gaylord Perry has done that. But again, for intended comic effect, you know, Gaylord Perry presents himself as very rich baseball character, and so that's him adding to that.
So one of the big things that happened this weekend is that the Minnesota Twins, who had been kind of fitfully drifting out of first place in the AL Central, swept the Cleveland Indians at home, that is the Indians' home park, and now find themselves back in first place by half a game. And I wrote about this for FanRag this morning. I just kind of took it position by position and tried to figure out, since these two teams were neck and neck, had the Twins really risen so far since last fall, or had the Indians really come down so far that there now was a parity between these two teams? And just doing kind of the subjective position by position thing, I still found it was almost all Indians.
Yeah, the Indians, I think, are a much better team than the Twins. There have been a few guys in their lineup who haven't really gotten the bats going yet. Edwin Encarnacion has started hitting really well recently, so that's one that wasn't there earlier that's getting to where they need to be. And you feel like they're going to break out and run away with the division, at least to some degree, eventually. Of course, they've also had some setbacks in the rotation. One thing that I found really fascinating about those two teams, really, is their home and road splits, specifically just their home and road records. The Twins had fallen back in the division, Cleveland had gone into first place, and there was a sense of, okay, this makes sense to me, everything is kind of the way it should be. And then Cleveland and Minnesota had the series coming up, and I think a lot of people were thinking, this is an opportunity for Cleveland to really... they could win this series and they could put some distance between themselves and the Twins in the division, but that obviously isn't what happened. But interestingly enough, last week they were in Minnesota and they swept four games against the Twins. On the season, Cleveland has a very good record against Minnesota. They are undefeated in Minnesota in, I believe, 7 games. But in Cleveland, the Twins are 5-1. And it's not just those two teams playing each other. Both teams have bad home records and excellent road records. The Twins, especially, the Twins are a 390 team at home and a 719 team on the road. And when you interact that with the fact that Cleveland also has a losing record at home and is over 600 on the road, you get this weird effect where when Minnesota shows up in Cleveland, they win. So yeah, I don't know to what degree this series that we just saw really reflects the true relationship between these two teams. But this thing about the home and road splits, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but one thing within those home road splits is that Cleveland is outscoring its opponents, not the Twins this weekend, but on the season as a whole, they're outscoring their opponents at home. So you feel like that might be part of the root of this fluke of why can't Cleveland get off the mat, whereas the Twins have been outscored at home by something in the order of 65 runs. There's one other thing that I look at with this duo, and that doesn't have to do with an ongoing issue. Certainly the home road split is an ongoing issue, but what their schedule has been to this point, they're both playing National League West teams in interleague play, but Cleveland has already faced Arizona and the Dodgers, and the Twins have not. The Twins have faced the Giants. They both faced the Rockies. But so there's a difference there too, is Cleveland has an awful interleague record. Certainly they should have done better against those teams no matter how good they are, because if we believe Cleveland to be a legitimate contender, they should be winning games even against the Dodgers in Arizona and Colorado. So the home record and the interleague record, those are kind of the two areas where Cleveland has been underperforming it and allowing the Twins, who I think are a very mediocre team, to stay in the race.
I don't see anything intrinsic about the two teams that would account for that home road disparity. I don't know if you do.
No, I don't. And another interesting home road split situation are the Rockies themselves. I wrote something, I can't remember at this point what year of the Baseball Prospectus annual it is, that the Rockies, you know, there's always been this issue. Certainly the Rockies home road, that's a big issue and it always has been. The question always was, how are they ever going to have effective pitching in Denver? What I've noticed over the years is that their far bigger problem is having effective hitting outside of Denver. That the gap between their offensive performance at home and on the road has always been larger than the gap between their defensive performance or pitching performance at home and on the road. But this year, the Rockies, who are winning, are playing very well on the road, and they're hitting on the road, and it's all working out for them. On a team level, it's difficult to suss out what's at the root of that. I was talking to Tim Flannery the last time I was on MLB Now, and he said, if you see a team with an excellent home record that struggles on the road, you know, there's a lot of explanations for that. We can talk about issues of just comfort, whether it's sleeping in a familiar place and not having jet lag or the batter's eye or the pitcher's mound or whatever it is, being comfortable, familiar. Flannery also suggested that very often there's some sign stealing can come into play. You know, I don't know to what degree, but he's like, oh, you know, we got a guy out there in center field. They got a guy out there in center field. Maybe that contributes. But to have such an extreme road performance doesn't make a whole lot of sense at all, because there's no consistency. It's not like they're playing in one place. The road isn't a single place. The road is, with interleague play, close to 20 different places. That's why the default position is to play better at home, because it's just harder to have consistent performance on the road. Certainly the Rockies have got some young players. They have, but, you know, again, the core is roughly the same. To see that much of a change, you kind of have to think of it as a fluke, but nonetheless, it's something that's happening and it's affecting their performance and it's affecting the standings.
One thing I always thought, not to get too far off the Indians and Twins before we're done with them, but with the Rockies, the thing that would equalize their offense between home and road is greater patience. One thing that in the roughly 25 years that the Rockies have been around that they've really rarely had is guys who are patient. If you take out Todd Helton and the aptly named Larry Walker, there really isn't a whole lot left. I mean, no Rocky other than Todd Helton has ever taken 100 walks in a season. It seems to me that home runs may be vulnerable to home and road distortion, and batting average can be vulnerable to the fact that they have a huge outfield, so there are bigger gaps for them to shoot for, so you can raise your batting average. But patience is patience. Plate judgment is plate judgment. And I don't know. I mean, maybe you could argue even that there's more of an incentive for guys to swing away at Colorado, and I'd love to see a study of that, that like walks in Colorado are a bad idea. But failing that, you can still get on base and then hit some singles or doubles on the road, and you don't have to wait for the home run and you'll still score some runs. But even though, as you say, they're hitting on the road this year, they're still 12th in the NL in walks. It's still an issue.
Again, it's difficult to make sense of it. I say they're doing well on the road. They've scored 4.6 runs per game on the road. But for a Rockies team, that's actually a really good number. Talking about the AL Central, the Kansas City Royals have been playing really well recently. And in April, they were brutal and they couldn't score at all. I think they were below 3 runs per game. Since they've kind of picked themselves up the mat the last 2 months, they've scored 4.5 runs per game. That's not great. And I think it's actually below league average right now. But again, the Rockies have a history of performing so badly on the road. They just wither completely on the road, historically speaking. Again, as a team, you'll get individual players who will have either a good individual season on the road or just an all-around quality player who can hit anywhere. But as a team, they wither below 4 runs per game on the road most seasons. So for them to be scoring 4.5 runs per game and outscoring their opponents on the season on the road, it's a very un-Rockies thing to be happening, but it's certainly a very large part of the success they've been having.
And one other note on the Rockies, Ian Desmond was a dumb signing when they signed him. He got hurt, sure, but he's been a terrible offensive player for them. And one of the guys who's causing that shortfall in walks, he has 7 walks in 213 plate appearances. Their intention was to play him at first base. Mark Reynolds saved them from their own stupidity there. But even that is incredibly lucky because he's unexpectedly at 33, being the best Mark Reynolds he could possibly be, or almost the best Mark Reynolds he ever has been. And yet they are still running Ian Desmond out there every day right now and just doubling down on that mistake. And they are going to stick with that mistake right through the end of the season, even though they have better choices.
Yeah, that signing didn't make any sense to me. And when they said first base, it multiplied the degree to which I couldn't figure out what they were thinking there. Looking at the Rockies lineup, Carlos Gonzalez hasn't hit much yet. Trevor Story isn't hitting. DJ LeMahieu, who does play excellent defense, so they've got that advantage there. It's kind of remarkable that the Rockies have been doing what they've done. They have even Nolan Arenado, who has been very good and was my pick to start at third base for the National League in the All-Star game. You know, I mean, his OPS right now is 117. That's not as good as he's done in the past, and that's not really an All-Star level performance if it wasn't for his glove, which of course is a huge part of his value. But just saying, with other guys not hitting in that lineup, the Rockies are a tough team to figure. I still see them as the second wild card out of it. I don't really see, I think they're going to hang with the Diamondbacks and the Dodgers, but it's really been interesting what they've been doing so far.
All right, so speaking of the Rockies, let's say you and I are on an especially pointless trivia game show where they have a category. We're going head to head. The category is ballplayers is seafood, okay? It's like Family Feud. We're just alternating. So you say Mike Trout, I say Dizzy Trout. You say Steve Trout. The host tells us to stop talking about Trout. So I say Tim Salmon. You come back with Catfish Hunter. And now I'm feeling desperate because I cannot recall Catfish Mekovich. I know he's out there, but I can't bring him up. So I think of the Rockies roster and I answer with Raymel Tilapia. You appeal to the judges. Do I skate by on this one?
I would love to give you credit for that, but no. Tapia. No, Tilapia, I like that, though. I kind of wish his name was Raymel Tilapia.
To me, no matter what I do, just mentally, he is Raymel Tilapia. I don't even like tilapia. It's, you know, it's one of those fish that people say, no, you should try it. It tastes like chicken. Well, I don't like chicken either. Who orders fish wanting chicken? But whether fish or fowl, whether poultry or something else, he should be playing ahead of Ian Desmond.
He's not hitting much either, Tapia. I just almost called him Tilapia. Thank you for that, Steve. I have to admit, I probably had that thought run through my head before, but now it's never leaving. The thing with Ian Desmond, though, is he's on that contract, and he's going to have to do a lot worse than he's doing to get out of the lineup. Tapia, you think there's some potential there, but I mean,
he's got some speed.
But Desmond has stolen 8 bases, which is not a lot, but it leads the team. They have like identical OPS right now. Certainly Tapia is in a much smaller sample. You know, I'd like to see Tom Murphy starting a catcher. That's one thing I'd like to see.
The good problem for them to have would be for David Dahl to come back, but you start getting nervous that David Dahl, with back and rib problems and everything, is just in kind of one of those Michael Brantley situations where you're going to go through the whole season with them saying, yeah, he's just around the corner. And then the next thing you know, it's spring training 2018, and they're like, well, he might be ready by May.
I think that's exactly what's going on with David Dahl. I don't think that they're expecting to have him back on the roster maybe until rosters expand. I mean, it sounds like he's a long-term DL situation right now. That's one of the things about the Rockies, is that I saw them as a sleeper in early March, and I'm sure I've said this probably on this podcast before. I saw them as a sleeper, and then they had all these late spring training injuries, and I said, oh, they're not so good of a team that they can endure those injuries. And then despite those injuries, they got off to this great start. And I said, oh, well, maybe if they get some of these players back, they can make this hot start real and be the kind of sleeper team I thought they would be in the first place. But now you get a guy like Dahl, who was part of that equation, possibly not coming back, possibly not making a big or maybe even any contribution to them this year. And you kind of wonder what is this team? The quality of team that they will be come the end of the season might be less than the level that they've played at thus far.
So you mentioned the Royals a few minutes ago, and they're another interesting team at this point in the season as we are cruising towards the All-Star break. They're at 500. They're 2.5 games out in the same soft division that we've been talking about with the Indians and the Twins. And yet, on a lot of levels, they're bad. I mean, they have as a team a 298 on base percentage, which is dead last in the league. And I don't know how you can win that way. I mean, the pitching has been shockingly good, or at least above average. That's part of what's holding them on. And they've had these flurries from Eric Hosmer, who got off to a slow start and then got really hot. Moustakas recovered from a slow start, although he's part of the problem with the on-base percentage because he's a guy who doesn't walk very often. He's 305. Alex Gordon is just a disaster for the second year in a row. Brandon Moss has totally failed at DH. So they're messy. I mean, you pointed out in your All-Star game piece that Salvador Perez is kind of the high point of this team, and I agree with that. And I'm purposely not mentioning Alcides Escobar because there's just no point, and have mercy on that dead horse, I think. Everybody on this team, it's not much of an exaggeration to say, everybody on this team is a free agent at the end of the season. So if they choose to hang in there and bid for this soft division title and not start dealing away these guys, they are really stuck because come the offseason, they're likely to leave anyway. Supposedly they're very hot to retain Hosmer. And fine, we can debate that too. But Hosmer by himself does not make for a team when Moustakas is gone and Lorenzo Cain is gone. And Jason Vargas, who really should be traded because he's a journeyman having a Cy Young season or a season that's at least going to get consideration for that, he should absolutely be traded like 2 minutes ago. But what do you do if you're the Royals?
It's a tricky question because, as I said before, they completely stumbled out of the gate. They went 7-16. That's a 304 winning percentage in April, scoring 2.7 runs per game. So they, you know, shot themselves. We weren't expecting a whole lot out of the Royals. We thought they might be kind of mid-pack. I don't think very many people were predicting that they were going to win the division. So a team with a bad projection stumbles out of the gate like that. I think everybody wrote them off. I certainly did. But then in May and June, they've gone 30-21, which is .588. And their offense has started to come around, like you've mentioned. They went from 2.7 runs per game in April to just under 4 in May. And in June, which is almost over, they've scored 5.2 runs per game. And when I was putting together, you mentioned my All-Star piece, when I was trying to assemble an All-Star roster for the American League, I was surprised at how often I found myself considering Royals. Perez is the only catcher in the American League who's qualified for the batting title right now, or at least a week ago that was true. He doesn't get on base very much, but he's slugging .528. He was an easy pick. Lorenzo Cain was one of my second string outfielders. He's actually having the best season of any everyday player on the Royals right now. He's really doing what he did a couple years ago when he finished third in the MVP voting. If you're able to see the totality of what he's doing, he's having an excellent season. Hosmer continues to be underwhelming to me as a first baseman for the total package, but he's above average at the plate. Whit Merrifield, who's a 28-year-old who continues to be the kind of like, well, we can't get anybody else to play well, so let's bring Merrifield back up. But he has played well.
I've written this a bunch of times, but they seriously, with the exception of like some brief flurries of production from someone like Mark Grudzielanek a million years ago, they have been struggling to find anything like a regular second baseman going back to the days of Frank White, which is getting to be a very distant time at this point.
Very long time ago. And Frank White wasn't really that much of a hitter either. He was an outstanding defender. But Merrifield's getting the job done. Jorge Bonifacio, who's a 24-year-old they called up, kind of low batting average, low on base percentage, but the total package is a slightly above league average bat. And for a position, he wasn't supposed to be their right fielder, but he's getting the job done. So their offense is kind of coming together. They do have a chance to go for it. But like you said, the cost of doing so is very, very high. Those players they have that could allow them to start a rebuild that could get them back to a more consistent contender status in the nearer future. Because if they go for it this year, win or lose, it's going to be bleak in Kansas City for maybe the next decade. And if they don't, I mean, they can get the Red Sox and the Yankees in a bidding war for Moustakas, and that would do them very well because those are two organizations that have very good farm systems. Just between Moustakas and Cain and Vargas, they could restock their farm system. Certainly from the outside, it's easy to be cynical and say, they can't go for it. That's ridiculous. They've got to cash these guys in. They've got to start a rebuild. If they do that maybe 3-4 years from now, they could have the next great Royals team. Looking at it from a Royals fan perspective or even from an organizational perspective, somebody in that front office, it's got to be awfully tempting. The second place team in the wild card right now is the Cleveland Indians, who are only two games ahead of them. They're in the race. It's a very difficult decision for them to make, and they're going to have to make it basically in the next 30 days.
Do you remember, this is going back literally 20 years ago now, I think I have the year right, the White Sox were in a similar position to the Royals, and about this time of year, they made what was called the white flag trade, where I guess ownership, Jerry Reinsdorf or whoever that was the GM at the time, just said, you know, we're doing decently right now. We have a shot, but that shot is really not worth pursuing. And they basically dumped a good fraction of their pitching staff over to the San Francisco Giants in exchange for some relievers and Mike Caruso, who was a shortstop prospect. And I don't know that that trade worked out terrifically for them in the long term, but it was certainly the cautious thing, the pragmatic thing to do, even though it was very deflating for their fans. And I understand that's a difficult thing to do, but I really feel like if you look at, even if the Royals held all those guys, even if they could win the division, can you really see them making it through a playoff series? Because it's Vargas in play for Rain unless Danny Duffy comes back. I guess he'll be back at some point, but he's out for the long term. And again, there are just too many outs in that lineup. I do want to say that since they sent down Jorge Soler and Raul Mondesi, those guys are really tearing it up at AAA. But I don't know if anybody really needs to see Raul Mondesi again anytime soon, given just how badly he's looked the two times that he has been up. And I think, you know, Soler will be a perennial prospect until he's 30. I don't know when or if he'll actually click, but those are dice they could roll at least.
Yeah, absolutely. That they can try that. Duffy actually could be back by the All-Star game. That's what they're looking for right now. Nate Karns has been out for a bit. He's more an after the All-Star break guy. And certainly Nate Karns is not of the quality of Danny Duffy, but he had been having a good season. And I've seen some things in Nate Karns in the last year or two that suggest that he should have better results than he has. But the thing about Kansas City in the postseason is, have we ever really been that optimistic about Kansas City in the postseason? I mean, they're constantly surprising us. That's another thing that's got to be in the minds of the front office and the management, the coaching staff, and even the players, is that, you know, just let us get in there, because we've been there before and we always play above our level in the post. Now, the more exposure, you would think that things will even out for them, but they have this history of proving people wrong in the postseason.
You mentioned Minor, and I think he's another guy. He's a great find in that he was a pretty decent starter for the Braves, and then his arm fell off. He missed 2 years, basically. Now he's in the bullpen. He's pitching very, very well, but a lefty reliever is a lefty reliever. I don't want to say that all of them are equally fungible, but outside of closer 100-mile-an-hour guys like Aroldis Chapman, to me, that seems like something that you might be able to take advantage of somebody's need and find somebody comparable in the future. Another guy we haven't talked about, and I don't hear anyone talking about this really, maybe because he's having a bad year, but Kelvin Herrera is ARB eligible for the third time after this season, and then he'll be also in his free agent walk year. So this would be a time to move him where, even though maybe his value is down slightly because he's given up a bunch of home runs this year, he's more than a rental, and there are other teams that might be able to better either sign him to a long-term contract if that's what they choose to do, or just absorb what will be a bump from arbitration.
I wrote a piece in late May, actually, that mentioned Herrera. I think Herrera and David Robertson, we hear a lot about Robertson right now, but those two guys, and Jim Johnson to the Braves is another one, although certainly maybe of lesser stature because he's bounced around a bit, but he's kind of back to the guy he was with the Orioles. All of those guys have another year of team control next year, but I think all of them should be on the market. It depends on whether or not the Royals are going to go for it or not. But Herrera, certainly, if they are not going to, if they are going to trade guys, I absolutely think Herrera is a guy they should look into trading. Now, the only hesitation I have there is, again, that he is not having his best season. He's striking out guys, but not at the elite levels that he has in the past. His walks are down, his home runs are up. You can sell a team and say, look, great arm, closer experience, playoff experience, all that sort of stuff. And with a year of team control, he may be as valuable now as he would be a year from now, pitching better, but without that extra year of team control. So maybe you break even right there. I totally agree on Minor. He's a 29-year-old who's having this strong relief season. And again, Minor, he's got the 1.880. Minor's kind of the opposite case of Herrera. He's got the excellent ERA, 1.88, but he's striking out about the same number of guys as Herrera per nine innings, but that's right around nine, which these days is pretty close to league average. He's only allowed one home run in 38 innings, which feels a little fluky. If they're going to sell Minor, maybe Soria, Herrera, they have absolutely pieces to deal if they're going to do it. And again, that's what makes that decision so hard for them.
I do want to talk about your All-Star game piece. I don't want to get into the question of whether anybody's really that hooked into it right now, because maybe I'm just disaffected. We'll dance lightly past that. But one thing that struck me about the roster that you picked, and you gave reasons for picking each name, is that you have but one member of the defending world champions on your National League roster, Chris Bryant, and you have him on the bench. And I wonder if that is just emblematic of what the Cubs are going through this year.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was very surprising to me. You know, I tried to be as fair as possible. I don't really have much of a, I don't have any really rooting interest anymore. So certainly I'm not going to favor one team over another. I'm just going by the numbers. Certainly there are some players that based on their reputation and their standing in the game, and Chris Bryant is one of those guys. Anthony Rizzo is one of those guys. You know, a year in, year out, one of the best players of the game, either at his position or in general, both of those guys qualify as that. Those guys I kind of had in the back of my head where I got to a certain point and I'm like, wait a second, where are those guys? First and third base in the National League this year is just so deep. There's so many good players at each position. Ryan Zimmerman had an outstanding start to the season, but he's fallen behind Paul Goldschmidt, who is another one of those, you know, year in, year out, you know, elite players that you feel like always has to be there. Joey Votto's having an outstanding season. There's just so many quality options at first and third base. And then at third base, obviously, you have Arenado, and you have Chris Bryant, you have Anthony Rendon, and Justin Turner, who was on the team that I put together. It was so as a result of that, because Bryant is not having his best season, Rizzo is not having his best season. Both of those guys are starting to heat up a little bit more now, which is very good news for the Cubs.
I mean, they're great seasons by anybody else's standards.
Right, exactly. But relative to themselves and relative to some of the really outstanding seasons that we're seeing at those two positions in particular in the National League this year, they were kind of second or third. And once you get to third on the depth chart in an all-star team, and they've cut a couple spots off the roster this year, we're down to 32, which I think is a good thing, but it makes those decisions harder. So I actually put Bryant on there because I needed to have some Cub. But if you look at the Cubs, if you look at the Cubs lineup, those two, Bryant and Rizzo, are the only two guys who have a triple-digit OPS plus. Some of them are hurt. Schwarber's back in the minor leagues, and the rest of them are not pulling their weight in terms of having even just a league average performance at the plate. And they're having issues in the rotation as well. The rotation has some age on it, and you could see some regression happening there, really with everybody. But for the young talent in their lineup to be having everybody kind of at the same time having an off year to different degrees, that I think is the most surprising thing.
I mean, part of the starting pitching also is that last year they were so defense dependent. They had they had, at least on the basis of defensive efficiency, the best defense in major league history. I'm not saying that they didn't deserve to have that, because Javier Baez is a great defender, Addison Russell is a great defender. But at the same time, I do think there's an element of luck to that, that just the trajectory of batted balls were in a place where people could get to them at a very high level. And maybe you don't have that 2 years in a row. And it's not a wholly controllable thing on their part. So in that sense, I think luck has gone against them. But you're right that overall the entire offense running backwards and is hugely surprising. And as you said, Rizzo, since they moved him to the leadoff spot, I love Joe Maddon's creativity. That's a great thing. I think by the time all is said and done, Bryant will be where we think he should be. But everybody else, like, is Zobrist old at 36? Ian Happ is still figuring things out, but he's been a real plus, but still, like, not necessarily somebody who's going to carry an offense. They're just missing a certain something. I almost feel like going Big Lebowski and saying, you know, they need something to tie the room together. I wrote something about this last week that I was kind of fantasizing about 1984 Ryan Sandberg being here, because that's the guy, and not that that guy is always or ever readily available, but the kind of player who has the day in, day out consistency, who's going to hit 300 and may not blast 40 home runs. Ryan Sandberg did that later, but at that time he was a guy who hit 310 and and hit double figure triples and hit a bunch of doubles and had 20 something home runs, not 40 something home runs, and was just the guy who was going to get his 1-for-3 on more or less a regular basis. They just don't have anywhere on the offense right now that kind of consistency.
To be fair, we have to point out Rizzo and Bryant certainly can be that type of guy, but they need help. They need, like you say, they need somebody to drive in other than themselves. And that's what's not happening with this team right now. Last year, Dexter Fowler had a big year and was a huge contributor in that way. He was the guy at the top of the lineup who was constantly getting on base. And the thing about Schwarber, you know, they sent him back down to the minors because he just really wasn't able to get off the mat. You talked about the luck that the pitchers had in terms of balls in play. Kyle Schwarber has had the opposite situation this year. He hit 12 home runs. He drew 36 walks. He's doing the things, you know, the secondary things that prove that he knows what he's doing at the plate, and that if he was hitting 280, we'd be saying he was having an excellent season, but he's hitting 170. To what degree is that his fault, or is he having bad luck? And, you know, I think at some point the Cubs had to give up on it because he offers you nothing on defense. He offers you nothing on the bases. So that batting average, even if it's not his fault, was dragging his production down so far. He was a sub-replacement level player. Whether or not a little time in the minors will allow him to iron out some sort of kink that might have been contributing to it, or give him a new start whenever they bring him back up, which I hope and assume will be relatively soon. I don't expect Schwarber to be down for very long.
Let me jump in and say there are two things here with Schwarber also to throw in. One is that he had a very hard time hitting left-handers. So that was another deficit that he had to be platooned, and that wouldn't be the end of the world. But even in the last month before he got sent down, where he had kind of a Joey Gallo kind of month, where he hit about 195, but like you said, with the walks and the power, that was with the most favorable matchups that Madden could find him, and he still couldn't quite get there. And one indicator for me that maybe it's not just luck, I mean, yeah, his batting average on balls in play is 193, and normally you might say that, yeah, like everything he hits is just making a beeline for gloves, but his line drive percentage was also really low. So he wasn't, I don't think, really squaring up the balls either. If you read Tom Verducci's book, they love this guy so much, not just on an ability basis, but on a personality basis. Like, they just look at him as the quintessential hitter. So it must have been like tearing off their own arms to send him down. But at the same time, sentimentality is the enemy of winning, and that was something they just really had to do at this point.
Yeah, no, it's true. And it's funny, I'm actually in the middle of that book right now, and I read the chapter on Schwarber probably a day or two ago. Yeah, they love Schwarber from the jump. Verducci makes a big point about Epstein's focus on character in that book. And there's absolutely true, because he's got Theo's words there, and there absolutely is an emphasis on personality and character and leadership and all these kind of old school qualities. But I feel like Verducci is trying to make a point. Maybe Epstein might not go as far as he's gone in that book. Verducci seems to be presenting that the Cubs decided that, you know, the new inefficiency was great character, and that they're going after character guys, and isn't Kyle Schwarber such a fantastic guy, and isn't Anthony Rizzo such a great leader, and that's why the Cubs won, and that sort of thing. But I think what he kind of skips over, and is in one or two of the comments there from the front office guys from the Cubs, is that character was kind of like the tiebreaker. It's that extra thing on top of all the other things. They're looking for a great player, and if they can find a great player who also has great character, he's the guy they want. You and I are great guys, Steve, but they don't want to sign us, you know? It's character alone is not going to get the job done. You've got to be able to hit like Kyle Schwarber or Anthony Rizzo first. You know, if you've got a Kyle Schwarber and an Anthony Rizzo and somebody else of comparable ability who's having some off-field troubles, you know, whoever it is, I don't want to defame anybody, so I'm not going to use an example. You know, then you're going to obviously go for the Rizzo or the Schwarber guy. There's a scene in Moneyball, the movie, and maybe in the book, where Billy Bean tells, I believe it's Art Howe, defense doesn't matter, which of course it does matter.
Right.
I think even before the movie came out, the Rays completely reversed the fate of their franchise by focusing on defense. So it's not that defense doesn't matter. It's that there are certain things that are more easily quantified, and there are certain things that might matter slightly more. And I think the relationship between ability on the field and character in the dugout and in the clubhouse or even off the field is similar here. And I think Verducci might have the ratio off a little bit in some of his writing. in that.
I know he does.
Yeah, exactly.
I know he does. And I'll tell you why. And I'm happy to defame somebody because it's not defamation. It's public knowledge. It's Aroldis Chapman. And that book, because Verducci is much more invested in that character is the new inefficiency thing than the Cubs probably are in real life, he gets himself, writes himself into a very difficult corner. And I enjoyed that book on a lot of levels, but it's a little too relentlessly positive about certain things that it should possibly be objective about. And that's one of them, because it spends the whole book going character, 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 leadership, only great guys. We're going to build around guys that are the best guys to be around. And then Aroldis Chapman becomes available, and he does cover the fact that, hey, this guy has a record of domestic abuse suspensions and all that. And you know what? The fact that he throws 100 miles an hour pins their desire for great characters in straight falls. It's just kind of like, oh, well, you can't have everything. And he glosses over that so fast and so hard and does not point up the hypocrisy that the Cubs just, they made a token effort to show that they cared. And as soon as, even in his very first press conference, Aroldis Chapman said something like, you know, I didn't learn anything. It wasn't really my fault. He showed them up right from the get-go and bitched at Madden about the way that Madden used him straight through, or at least after he left for the Yankees. And I'm sure they don't regret it. They won a championship. They did what they were supposed to do. But they would have acquired Shoeless Joe Jackson or Chick Gandel or somebody if that had been on option, and Verducci would have passed that over too.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And I'm only halfway through the book, so I haven't gotten to the Chapman part.
Spoilers.
Oh no, you told me they won the World Series. You ruined the whole ending, Steve. but yeah, exactly. So its character is important, but it's not as important as ability and talent. And that's all I've ever been saying. I don't know if it was my last appearance on this podcast or two ago, I told you about that heart and balls conversation I had with Al Leiter, and it was the same point. It was, yeah, sure, that's great. If you're the guy who has great leadership and you're the guy who has a work ethic and all these things, that's going to make you better. If you're going to get more out of your talent than another player with the same level of talent who doesn't have those qualities. But the talent sets the bar. It sets the level of what you can accomplish. All the character in the world isn't going to make you a great Major League Baseball player. And even if you're a marginal Major League Baseball player, all the character in the world isn't going to make you a great Major League Baseball player. And teams like that have to make those, even if they have, you know, a focus on character, they're at some point going to have to compromise. People are complicated and they're complex, and baseball is baseball. And, you know, it's difficult to put too much emphasis on one thing. And as much as I like that book, I think that Verducci kind of uses the Cubs a little bit to make his own point in a way that's unfair.
We're getting very near the end here. And I just wanted to ask you this, which is, as usual, a little off the square of what we do. But we always talk a little bit about music, and we always reflect on your experience writing about that and your love of the history of rock and roll. And for all I know, you can opine on Gershwin, too. I haven't asked you, but I should do that someday. My wife, we're going to celebrate our 19th wedding anniversary this week.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And we've been together longer than that. So really, we're somewhere in the 20s, if you want to really be honest about it. So we were having this very sentimental talk and this very honest talk. And as I think you know from being in a very long-term relationship, in any period of time, you may keep loving each other, but there are moments where you're closer than others, where you each may be more involved in your own lives. And so sometimes you're incredibly, incredibly tight as you ever were from the first day that you met or the first day you fell in love. And other times maybe it's more friendly. And part of balancing a relationship is making sure to modulate at those times, making sure you don't have too many long periods where you settle into being more roommates than lovers and so forth. Anyway, we're having this sort of long, very positive survey conversation of our relationship and wanting to deflate the moment in some way. It was getting a little heavy, you know. I just suddenly, and I don't know why I did this, I don't know where this came from, as she said something about relationships and love, I burst out singing, I want to know what love is. I want you to show me. And I hate that song. I didn't even know, I couldn't even think at that moment of who had done that song. So I rapidly recalled that it was Foreigner, and it was a huge international hit about 1985. And it doesn't make me feel any better. But so I go to the Wikipedia and I'm reading down the history of Foreigner and all their many huge hits. And Foreigner had an experience, I think, is very common to rock and roll bands, which is there were kind of one or two guys at the core of the band and then a few others that I guess they thought were more fungible. As you're trying to maintain this complex system, you're trying to get five guys to get along and stay along and be on the same page creatively. There's a lot of entropy that happens and the band falls apart. They start peeling off members until essentially you're down to one guy and an oldies tour with four ringers and something like that. And I know we've had this conversation before. I've said to you, like, do you want to go see such and such a tour? And you've said, well, is it actually them?
Yeah.
And I've had that conversation with other people too. Like a friend of mine said, I saw Chicago the other day. They were a great show. And I said, well, was so-and-so there? No. Was so-and-so there? No. Was Zatera there? No. Well, then it wasn't Chicago. It was just a bunch of guys with the Chicago name, or it was just the bassist or the third drummer or something who's allowed to use the name. And it seemed to me, and this is especially poignant because one of the key guys in Foreigner was named Mick Jones, but he wasn't the Mick Jones. He wasn't the Clash's Mick Jones. And Mick Jones was a guy who got fired from the Clash by Joe Strummer. And you can't do that and still be the Clash, as I think Joe Strummer found out. What is it about rock bands where they have to keep peeling away guys until you find the inflection point for no longer being a successful band? And does that same battle against entropy and keeping a complex system in order, is it comparable to the way that baseball teams have to be maintained?
An interesting question. There are some bands, and my wife of will be 11 years later this year. We've been together for 24, just to get the actual numbers. we've started going to a lot more concerts recently. They've been a lot of these kind of oldies acts. I consider, you know, bands from the 80s mostly. There is a focus on who's still in the band. And is this really the band? You know, some of the bands, we saw the Go-Go's Farewell Tour last year, which was everybody except the bassist. They got a new bassist. That's pretty good. That's not too bad. She Loves the Bangles. We saw the Bangles. Their bassist had also, interestingly enough, had a split with the band. So they had a replacement bassist. But in this case, instead of hiring another woman, they hired basically like a male studio musician and kind of stuck him behind a curtain or something. So there were three people on stage and a mystery bass coming from nowhere. And other bands like that. We were recently talking about whether or not we should see Blondie on the tour that they're on right now. And Debbie Harry's there and Chris Stein's there and the drummer's there. I don't think the keyboardist is. And the guys they added for Parallel Lines are gone. And there's a bunch of teenagers that flesh out the band. There's too many guys who look like they weren't born when Parallel Lines came out or whatever. So I'm not so sure if it's a weird feeling. But there are bands that have been able to stick together in something close to their, whether it's not their original lineup or, you know, have some consistency of membership for decades upon decades, which you cannot do with a baseball team because guys hit a certain age and you just can't do it anymore. And, you know, it's interesting to see in rock and roll or rock music or music in general, guys can play, they can continue to perform surprisingly close to, you know, they're not going to be as electric and exciting as they were when they were 25 or whatever it was when they were at their peak, but they can continue to do it. And baseball teams, just age is a factor in a way that's different. And of course, the other thing with baseball teams is, you know, with free agency and things like that, there's not a sense that the players are so essential to the brand. It's the old Jerry Seinfeld thing about rooting for laundry. The Rolling Stones or Blondie or whoever else, they don't wear uniforms. So you can't just, you know, stick a guy in the outfit. And I mean, Kiss did that for a while, though. They stuck a I think they're still doing it because they're permanently on the outs with it. Whether or not they're playing anymore, I don't even know. Don't keep track. But at some point, they just permanently decided that's it. You know, Ace and Peter are never going to play with us again. We've got two other guys. We're going to put them in their makeup and nobody will care or know the difference, which is not entirely true. But so there's one or two bands that will stick a guy in the outfit. And so I don't think the parallel is perfectly there. I think it's more economic and age forces in terms of baseball and in rock bands and such. It's more ultimately personality driven. You know, it's an art. It's not a baseball's more of a science. And the ability to create is not what's happening on the baseball field. It's the ability to physically perform on some level.
Well, let me push back just in this sense, because recently there was some discussion, particularly a lengthy article in the New York Times, about why the Yankees haven't drawn up to expectations in their current ballpark. And one argument I would make, the obvious argument is, of course, that they haven't been all that successful to this point or since they last won the World Series. I mean, they've had winning seasons, but without, you know, they've missed the playoffs and not been that exciting. But I think the other part, you mentioned this about the players not being considered essential to the brand. When the Yankees had the homegrown core of their great teams in the 90s, the Jeters and Bernie Williamses and the Andy Pettits and Posadas, Yankees fans, for basically the first time in the George Steinbrenner or Steinbrenner family ownership years, got a sense of what it was like to root for homegrown players, players that you could write your own legend or myth about and grow with. And it's a little different than having these veteran mercenaries come in. And like you said, you root for the laundry or you root for the brand to do well, but you don't have that attachment. And I don't think that as good at times as guys like Brian McCann, Teixeira, and Jacoby Ellsbury, or even A-Rod might have been, and I'm just maybe speaking for myself, but I think this is true. I think it, reasonably, there's not the same excitement and affection for them that there would be if they had been there since they were 22. I think Aaron Judge is displaying that in some ways, and not just because Aaron Judge, there's a lot to kind of hang a hook on, being that he's 7 feet tall and hitting 330 with incredible power, and his name, of course. You can see that, though, that combination of things, people have really taken to him right away in, I think, a way that they wouldn't have had he been 31 and come over from the Giants in a free agent deal.
Absolutely, there's that fan connection thing and that identification with the players. But, I mean, you mentioned the Yankees. I think the biggest impact on the Yankees' attendance is that their new ballpark is just so incredibly unfriendly to fans, whether it's ticket prices or ticket locations or the proximity of the upper deck to the field. There's just so much about the new ballpark that is uncomfortable and unfriendly to your middle and lower income fans that I think they basically shut the door on a lot of fans almost deliberately. And I think that's had a big impact. There are so many factors at play looking at their attendance in the final years of the old stadium, because certainly there's the fact that, hey, we're going to move, so this is your last chance to come. But yeah, I mean, the 05 and 06 type Yankee teams, they had outstanding attendance, but those were not really the core four teams. Jeter was still there and Rivera was still there, but those were the teams that were going one and out in the division series every year with the Gary Sheffields and those type of guys, and Jason Giambi, even Mike Mussina, big free agent type guys, not necessarily guys who you saw come up through the minor leagues in the system. But their attendance was as high as it's ever been during those years. Whether or not that was because the ballpark was closing or economic factors, that was right before the 08 collapse, the recession, so things are pretty good financially. I don't know. I do think there's absolutely a connection to those players. Time and again, the thing that matters most when it comes to baseball attendance is just winning. And it doesn't matter who you're winning with, it's winning. The Yankees are winning this year, and Judge is having that great year, and their attendance per game is up versus last year, but only a little bit. I mean, it's still the second worst year they've had in per game attendance since 1998. And oh, by the way, 1998. Right? Sometimes it's a year after effect in terms of winning. You look at the Blue Jays when they finally made the playoffs a couple years ago and their attendance went way up. They had excellent attendance down the stretch and they were packing the ballpark in the postseason. But then it was the next year that you really saw the big bump. People buy those tickets based on, hey, they were pretty good last year, let's go. So maybe next year the Yankees might get a nice bump from what they're doing this year and from Aaron Judge and all that kind of thing. But if Matt Holliday was having that kind of season, I think it would be a similar impact as long as it translated to winning.
I think you're right. I mean, I do think winning is the biggest thing. But I still do like your parallel, whether you intended it or not, that KISS guys who are not actually members of KISS in KISS makeup are kind of like Yankees in Yankees uniforms that are not actually the Yankees. That this is the faux Yankees. If not now, then certainly then.
That gets dangerously close to the concept of the true Yankee, though, Steve. It gets really close to that, and that's not a thing.
No, well, that's as much a thing as people who will look at the president and say, today is the day that Donald Trump became presidential. It's bull. It's as much bull as true Yankee. Why is he a true Yankee? Because he hit a walk-off home run. Oh, there's a long list of players who have hit walk-off home runs in whatever uniform. I hate that. And it's just a sales thing. And it's a sales thing or an apology or something when it happens in politics, too. So you're right. I will reformulate my thinking here. Cliff, as always, thank you very much for coming by and taking your regular turn at bat here. And I look forward to the next time.
Thank you for letting me rant about ridiculous stuff.
Good grief, Charlie Brown, we've made it to the end of another episode. You can read Cliff at Sports on Earth and follow him at Twitter at Cliff Corcoran. My own writing appears 3 times a week here at FanRag, and you can follow me on Twitter at GoStephenGoldman. That's short for Go Forth and Seek Your Destiny. You can also write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com, and please rate us at the podcasting service of your choice. It helps. We have no sponsor as of yet, so let's just say Sesame Street style that this week's episode is brought to you by the number 19. Our producer was running a hairdryer throughout the recording of this entire episode, and I am so sick of that kind of selfish behavior. Our theme song, which you have heard throughout this episode and in fact are listening to now, was composed by myself and Rick Mooring, who is presently vacationing at the Black Sea port of Sevastopol, and he didn't invite me. Well, assuming the cat doesn't go feral and start a nuclear war under the bed, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.